we have not left the Channel Home Center's gross street completely. I want to come back to it and think about what standards are really being applied in these cases or what should be applied. But let's move on to what for me is the saddest case in the casebook. The reason it's the saddest case is that all law professors, almost all law professors in the United States, as well as many school teachers in the United States, have their pension plans in TIAA, CREF. And when I think that about TIAA's willingness to enter into this venture with my money, it makes me slightly ill. And but on the other hand, I suppose that it comes out all right because they never make the loan, but on the other hand, they're going to get some money out of it. But the notion that they would like to enter into this transaction is one that I find slightly appalling. Nevertheless, it's my pension company. This is another case in which the issue before the court was whether or not the parties who had clearly not yet reached mutual assent, they had not really reached the point of a meeting of the minds on the basis of which the court could find there was a final contract, that nevertheless, could the court find that there was something that the parties did that would render them liable for their performance? Now, this performance that we're talking about is performance during negotiation for a contract. And I think I should have said before, although maybe it's clear from these materials, that at least in common law, traditional contract law, while the notion that you had to perform a contract in good faith is actually quite an old doctrine, been more clearly articulated now, but the doctrine itself is very old, there was no, I underscore, no position in the law that you had to bargain in good faith. Now, there were some restrictions on what you could do. You couldn't lie, right? You couldn't commit fraud. You couldn't compel a signature through the use of force, you know that. Certainly not through physical force, and maybe not through economic force. We've talked about that a bit. But there were not very many limits on how you behaved during the bargaining process. The notion was that contract law became effective and the obligations of contract law became effective at the point after you had reached mutual assent. In a way, before that, it was none of the society's or the court's damn business. That was essentially the notion of contract law. Well, you can see that that's hasn't gone away, but on the other hand, you can see the courts here wrestling with a question that could be put this way. Is there a certain point during bargaining, before mutual assent, and yet at that point, some legal obligations are applicable to the way in which you conduct yourself? If so, that's a distinctly different position than the common law of contracts had taken, the traditional common law contracts, which said you didn't have any obligations short of not cheating, stealing, and so on. And courts are still wrestling with this question. So we saw how that worked out in the Channel Lumber versus Grossman case, where the court had before it a written agreement which was styled a letter of intent, but which clearly spelled out one obligation. That was an obligation on the part of Grossman's to withdraw the property from the market, not to be offering this property to anybody else for lease. That includes not Mr. Goodbyes. By the way, their claim was they didn't offer it to Goodbyes. Goodbyes came along and offered to them. So, if you would like to accept that distinction, you can. The court obviously paid no attention to it whatsoever, which is, I think, probably what it deserved. I take it that when a owner of property says, I'm taking the property off the market, that doesn't mean just that I won't try to find a new lessee. It also means that if a potential lessee comes and talks to me, I'll say, I'm sorry, at the moment I have a preliminary obligation. However, I'm glad to hear of your interest, and I'll get back to you if the deal that I'm working on now does not, in fact, come to pass. However, the court went beyond that, and the court said, well, not only is that provision binding, but also they've reached a certain point at which a larger obligation has become appropriate, namely the obligation to bargain in good faith. And the question for us is, first of all, I suppose more generally, is that a good idea? I mean, the jurisprudential questions, were they right at common law and just leave the parties alone until they reach agreement? Was that a better position? And then the second position is, if the court is right that at some point a bargain, a obligation, a duty to bargain in good faith is created by what the parties have done up to that point in their preliminary negotiation, then the question is, at what point? How do we know it when we reached it? And then there's a third question, of course, the one that no one will ever answer, and that is, well, what exactly does it mean to have to bargain in good faith? We'll make a couple of stabs at that, and a little later on in the course, we're going to talk more about what the term good faith means in the courts these days. The same set of questions really arises in connection to before Judge Laval, Pierre Laval in District Court in the Southern District of New York, and Teachers Insurance and Annuity Association of America versus Tribune Company. Had they reached a point in their bargaining in which Tribune had some additional obligation, not just to refrain from cheating and stealing and lying, but that they have some larger obligation, that they have an obligation to carry on bargaining in good faith. This case also has a specific action that we could focus on. In this case, however, unlike the Channel Lumber's case, where the specific action is indeed the very action which was precluded by the written agreement, well, written letter of intent, which the court says is an agreement. In this case, we're dealing with something quite different. We're dealing with an insistence by the Tribune on introducing into the bargaining a term as a kind of sine qua non. We will not continue with our discussion unless you agree to. And it was something which had not been part of what the court sees as a preliminary agreement or preliminary negotiation and the outlines of an agreement. Outlines which were sufficiently certain, sufficiently clear in the view of Pierre Laval, Judge Laval, so that an obligation to bargain in good faith has now arisen. And they were working. Now, this is as you probably realize, reading this is again a decision under Erie Railroad versus Tompkins. It's a diversity case. They have to apply New York law. And so you see a lot of references to the Winston case, which was a decision by the New York Court of Appeals, which had in fact recognized that under some circumstances, this kind of duty might be created. However, in the Winston case, it was not. So they're working with a set of standards which the court talked about, although what exactly it took to satisfy those standards was not that clear in New York cases, but perhaps it becomes clear, at least as the federal court claims that they are interpreting state law, which of course is what happens in every diversity case under Erie Railroad versus Tompkins, for better or worse. So, what is it the court looked at in TIA versus Tribune? What is it they looked at in reaching the decision? Okay, they have in fact carried on their preliminary bargaining, their preliminary negotiation in a way which brought them to a point at which each side had a duty to bargain in good faith. Because that's what he ultimately decides, then we can talk about what the consequence of that finding. But we have to first talk about what it was that brought them to this point.
Well, if I understand that correctly, they looked at four different elements.
Okay, what are the elements?
The first one was whether parties expressly reserve the right not to rebuttal, and they could do it by either absence or in writing. The second one was...
What did they say about that?
Well, they said that there was no such intent shown, because based on the Tribune's letter, they had reserved...
The TIA had reserved the money.
Yes.
And how about on the Tribune side?
The Tribune side requested a firm offer to be, I guess, confirmed by a certain date.
Right. Not only did they request a firm offer, but when the firm offer came back, it came back saying you have to agree to it.
Yeah.
And what did they do?
They agreed to it.
Now, let's step back about this for a second. Some of you may have been involved in financing transactions, maybe in the acquisition of a house, if any of you have done that. It is true that often banks are prepared to make loan commitments without any obligation on the part of the potential borrower promising to borrow. Now, the bank can withdraw that commitment at any time, although the bank's practice is to make those offers, put a time period on them, frequently 30 days, and the borrower has to make a demand on the bank within that 30 days to complete the lending arrangement. So it's not unknown that you could have a kind of one-sided action on the part of a lender, so the lender could be bound, but the borrower could not be. Yeah. You could stop and say to me, yeah, but it's not a sale of goods, and that offer is not supported by consideration, and therefore they could probably simply withdraw it because it's not an option. That's probably right. But the practice in the banking world is to make those commitments, state them for a period of time, and adhere to them. Why? Well, because it's good business practice and it's a way of attracting customers. Because you want customers, you want people to come and ask you, and some of those will turn into deals and some will not. However, that's not always the case. In some cases, particularly in large commercial loan arrangements, the lender will say, well, let's make a deal now. We'll lend you the money, you must agree. And that's what TIA did. Ordinarily, the Tribune would have turned this down. Their lawyers would have advised them to turn it down, so would their accountants. Why didn't they turn it down? Why didn't they turn it down? Why didn't they say to TIA, look, that's not the way it works. You tell us whether you're interested in making this loan. We'll let you know whether we want it.
Well, there were other circumstances.
Yes, what were they?
That the rates went down.
No. I'm talking about at the very moment that there was this, quote, agreement between TIA and Tribune, when TIA said, we'll lend you the money, but you have to agree to these arrangements.
Well, they've been having trouble getting other lenders.
How much trouble?
A lot of trouble.
Yeah.
Turned down.
They asked, what, six?
Yeah.
Got turned down by five. This is their last one. That was the compelling circumstance. So, is it not compelling by law, but compelling in business? This was the last effort. That's a lot of people to ask for money. Even more than this, a lot of people turning you down. You begin to get the message that maybe this is not an attractive transaction to lenders. I feel that way as a owner of shares of Tia Kreff through my pension. I don't think it's a good deal. So, but they said yes. So the point was that the court was making is that far from any reservations of rights to decline, statements which made it clear that people were not feeling bound. This is exactly the opposite. This is TIA saying, we will be bound and we want you bound. And what they're bound to, of course, is fragmentary. right? And that's the problem. If the terms were clear, as all the terms of the loan had been negotiated, not just the amount and the interest, but if they had also negotiated all the other terms of a loan, of a big commercial loan, but it had been done orally, and they had said, okay, we're in agreement, shaking hands on the agreement, and said, but of course our lawyers have to put it in writing. And the other side had said, yes, of course. That would have fallen into a category which even old traditional common law courts would have recognized. They would have said, you know something, that's enforceable. Because the language, well, it'll have to be put in writing, is simply saying that the parties agree that there should be a memorial of their agreement. That's what it's always referred to, a memorial. I know that sounds a little like a sick joke, but memorialization. And far from symbolizing a lack of mutual assent, it does just the opposite. It says the parties have reached agreement and they simply want it to be put in writing. And therefore, when it never does get put in writing, the courts nevertheless were willing to enforce it. But they didn't see that as an example of an incomplete bargaining process. They saw it as a completed bargaining process. Mutual assent has been achieved, but the parties have agreed that it should be put in writing. But from the legal point of view, mutual assent had been achieved, and if it does not require writing under the statute of frauds, and an agreement of this kind would not, then it's binding despite the fact that there never is a writing that gets signed by both parties. This case did not fall, and the court mentions that, Laval mentions that, but this case doesn't fall within the parameters of that doctrine because it's clear that they had not yet agreed on all the terms. So what we have is we have a situation in which we have a firm commitment of some kind or another. It's a commitment to make a loan, a commitment to borrow the money, but it's not a full agreement because too much of what has to be agreed to by the parties in order for it to be an effective commercial loan has not yet been agreed to. But when it comes to the question of, well, were the courts reserving a right to get out, Laval says, well, not really. I mean, they recognize the fact that at the completion of negotiation, they may never agree, in which case there won't be a contract. But that's different, he says, than reserving the right. After all, if that's what reserving the right means, then there is no second doctrine. Because all the cases that would come up under the second doctrine, the duty of bargain and good faith, would be cases in which necessarily there were things yet to be negotiated and therefore yet to be agreed on. So he says what we look for instead is whether there was a commitment on each to something that was done in a way which does not suggest a reservation of some privilege to just say, oh, I'm tired of talking, I'm finished. So I met that standard. Standard number two. You offered four.
The second one was whether there was partial performance on either part.
Yeah, he says one of the things that New York courts looked at is to see whether either one had partially performed. Why? Why do you think that would be an important standard?
Well, in this case, there was only limited funds that they could have dispersed between Tribune and other competitive borrowers.
But you're answering the question of how the court applied it to these facts. My question is, why do you think a court would think that performance by either or both of the parties should be one of the elements that the court would take into account in deciding whether or not they had reached the point at which a duty to bargain in good faith should be implemented?
Because one party would be taking on a detriment
of some sort? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we've seen this before. This is the court's concern for detrimental reliance. So if there is some detrimental reliance, that would be an instance in which one factor, not the not exclusive, not the single persuasive factor, but a factor in measuring whether the parties have reached that point. Now, you started to say, but I didn't let you finish, I'm sorry. What exactly here, who did what that was detrimental?
I think what happened is that it was the end of the year and the plaintiff had only a certain amount of funds available at this point. So they actually, by promising to give the money to the defendant, they lost the opportunity to actually go and seek other borrowers.
Yeah, I think they actually did more than that. I think the court suggests that they had actually kind of marked it as reserved. They had marked it as, okay, this is the money for the Tribune deal. And the court says that's detrimental for the reason you suggest, because they're in the business of lending that money. I mean, as always, of course, as a pension plan holder, I think they're in the business of paying me my pension, but from their point of view, they're in the business of lending money, and that's how they make money. In all fairness, they are a non-profit institution, so the money they make belongs to everybody who has pensions in TIAA Credit. Okay, that's two. Number three?
The customary practice, or would that fall under the...
Say a few more words about it, and I'll tell you.
Whether the terms of the contract didn't have to be all in there, because they would look at the field where the contract was made and see if they were required to be in there.
Okay. So that one of the things you want to look at is you want to see how this trade, if you will, which is lending and borrowing, how it generally conducts itself. Were there agreements on some of the what are regarded by the trade as the principal elements that have to be agreed upon? And they said yes. Remember that this was done, as so many deals are, on the basis of what is called a term sheet. I've used that terminology before. The term sheet was drawn up by Tribune. It stated the outlines of the deal that they wanted from anybody who was going to lend them money. It was that term sheet that they sent to these six potential financing agencies, all turned it down except TIAA Credit. When TIAA responded, they built that term sheet into their responding term sheet that they sent forward for signature by Tribune. And so the court looked at it and said, well, you know, all of these are clearly the critical terms of the deal. They are how much money, when does it have to be loaned, the principal terms of the loan were all there, and there was a lot else to be negotiated, but those were the things that the industry would have looked for as the principal elements, and they had been agreed to, actually signed in that sense, by the Tribune at the insistence of TIAA. And what else?
Well, the last one I have is the whether there was a type of writing usually agreed upon.
Okay, so was there some writing? There was some writing that was agreed upon? Now, you say all these things, and so the question then becomes, all right, the parties have reached a point. After all, this was a loan agreement. Remember that the complexity of the Tribune deal with its building and the so-called purchaser of the building, that deal was not part of this deal. I mean, this deal was a financing deal, and the financing deal was going to get wrapped up in this supposed sale. But the terms with TIAA Credit would be terms which were essentially terms of a loan. And there were, incidentally, some very knotty, undecided questions, which the court could have rested upon saying, well, no, they don't have them agreed on quite enough. If you understood this deal at all, those of you who read it and tried to work through it, what would you say is a critical issue here from the standpoint of TIAA that is unresolved?
Isn't there something like they didn't know if they were definitely going to make the sale to LaSalle or something?
And what difference would that make?
Well, if they weren't going to make the sale to LaSalle, then they would not, the deal wouldn't work because, like, they were going to take the, LaSalle's promise to pay them a mortgage and transfer it to the teachers.
And then what would happen to the, to this note?
Then they would not, they wouldn't want the loan from teachers if LaSalle wasn't going to give them a mortgage.
Okay. So was that contingency then a contingency that TIA would have wanted to negotiate about?
I mean, considering that if that condition didn't occur, then the whole deal wouldn't go through. I think it's up in the air whether, I mean, whether that condition is part of the agreement that they're going to reach or not, if that hasn't been decided, that seems like something's missing.
If you take a look at page 557, I mean, you're on the right trail. In the second paragraph, in the middle of the paragraph, the loan agreement with a lending institution, that's the deal between Tribune and TIA, would provide the Tribune could pay off its own note to the institution by putting, delivering to the institution in place of its own note, the non-recourse mortgage note the Tribune would receive from LaSalle. To compensate the lending institution for the additional risk inherent in the possible put, Tribune would pay the lender a premium above market interest rates. So there are several elements which are of concern to the person who's the lender. Among other things, what they'd be getting is, instead of the note of the Tribune, they would be getting a non-recourse mortgage note. You don't understand what non-recourse mortgage note means? It means you can foreclose the mortgage, but you can't sue for the debt. Now, that works out okay if the value of the property is sufficient to cover the loan. If the value of the property is not sufficient to cover the loan, you are at risk. That's the additional risk. And so, because TIA would be undertaking that risk, TIAA was in fact going to get a premium. That means more money. A premium in order to compensate it for the additional risk. So obviously, when they sit down and write out this agreement, it's going to have to deal with this. It's going to have to describe these arrangements. It's going to have to say that Tribune has the right to substitute for its note a non-recourse note that it receives from this third party. But the court felt, okay, well, that remains to be negotiated, that remains to be dealt with, but it's not one of the principal elements. Now, among other things, notice that unlike the issue of the accounting handling of this transaction, the off the books or whatever they call it, accounting, this one was known in the term sheet that TIA received, and it's reflected in the sheet that, therefore, the term sheet that TIA sent back to the Tribune. Not the details of it, but the general notion that that was the transaction. So the court was not troubled by the fact that there are more details to be worked out because the overall framework of this kind of arrangement was explicit, not implicit, but explicit in what was in writing between the parties. So now we reach the point of saying, okay, so we've satisfied that, we're satisfied under these standards that the Winston case came up with in New York, and we think therefore they've really reached the point where they have to bargain in good faith. And then the question for the court becomes, okay, well, what does that mean? How do we know? On what basis do we decide whether they bargain in good faith? Now, that has to mean something other than the parties didn't reach an agreement. Because by definition, if you're still bargaining in good faith, you can still fail to reach agreement. What happened here that made the, that led the court to say not part of good faith?
Tribune wanted to add basically a condition in the agreement that wasn't within the scope of the bargain. They had never discussed the offset accounting and the condition that their accountants would agree to the offset accounting when their accountants didn't agree, they backed out.
Okay, let's be exact about this now. Was TIA unaware, did they have any basis for being aware of the fact that this was an idea that the Tribune had, or did they have some notion about it?
No, basically it wasn't.
That's the question. And some parts of this can be read that way, but is it really right? What do you think from what Laval says about what he tells us about the transaction? Was it the case that they had never disclosed to TIAA some concern about the issue of what their accountants, how the accountants would agree to treat this? I know it's a very long opinion. I want to reference to the Laval opinion, however.
Well, on page 569, conditions precedent to enforcement near the bottom of this last full paragraph. What in fact happened was the other way around. Tribune broke off the contract negotiations by insisting on a condition, satisfactory accounting, which I assume is another language for offset accounting, that was not within the scope of the agreement. So my assumption is it wasn't in the scope of the agreement, but they were discussing it based on that.
Anything more directly that's sort of indirect?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's the written agreement between the two parties contained no basis for the proposition that the obligation was conditioned on satisfactory assurance that it would be off the balance sheet. So there was they had talked about it, but the court didn't feel it was really a conditional, it was a conditional part of the
distinction, that's right. The distinction that Judge LaValle is making is that TIAA knew about the fact that they had in mind this issue of whether or not the accountants would permit this offset accounting to be used, but it had never been put to them as a critical term in connection with TIAA. So if they knew that it's something that the Tribune was hoping for, but they did not know that the interest of Tribune in carrying forward this entire arrangement was controlled by whether or not the accountants, their accountants, would agree to this particular accounting method. And so it's not that they didn't sort of know about the fact that Tribune was hoped that they could do this kind of accounting, but rather that from TIA's point of view, the Tribune had never said to them, you understand that we want to make an agreement with you to borrow the money from you, but it's conditioned on our getting our accountant to sign off on a particular method of accounting for this transaction. And so when they came back to TIAA and said to TIAA, oh, well, we're not interested in talking to you about all the things you'd like to talk to us about until you agree that we're going to include a provision which says that our obligation is contingent upon, it's conditioned on our accountants approving this method of accounting for this transaction. And TIAA said, and Laval supports this notion, that this is the first time that Tribune had ever said that this agreement that they were going to reach with TIAA was conditioned upon something which, of course, had absolutely nothing to do with TIAA at all, but had everything to do with the Tribune's accounts. And what did he say about that? How does Laval feel about their raising that issue?
Well, he feels like it clearly was not a required condition because he had ignored Tribune
Tribune's counsel had told them, hey, don't sign that binding agreement, and you need to raise the question, and they failed to give any of that. So he thinks they're using it as just a way to get out of it.
Well, and we're going to talk about that issue in a minute, about what the motivation, why he thought they were highly motivated to get out of it. But I think that he says something more precise than that, and not dependent upon the fact that he thought they were trying to weasel out of the deal.
But, I mean, just because of the way this whole, they want the history of it, didn't they say he was trying to downplay, they were trying to downplay that part of it initially, because I think there was some concern that they really emphasized that they wouldn't be as excited about doing the loan. So there was...
Okay. So one of the problems, of course, one of the reasons that they probably didn't make it clear in the way in which they dealt with TIAA is that they had been turned down by all the lenders except TIAA. This did not seem the right moment to try and raise something that you knew the lender would not be interested in, because it makes the lender's whole deal contingent upon this, what some accountant is going to say about the transaction. They only care about what their accountant will say, and their accountant would not have been troubled by what was going on here. But more than that, here's the proposition, isn't it? When I try to define, I need to try to define, as a lawyer, I need to try to define what it means to bargain in good faith. Because you know something, I'm going to be advising a client who's going to be in some long-term negotiation, and they're going to get to some point of letter of intent, or something which looks like it, some commitment, and I'm going to have to say to them, well, you know, after this you have to bargain in good faith. And my client is going to justifiably say to me, okay, what does that mean I can do, and what does it mean I can't do? Don't trouble me with your fancy language, counselor. Just tell me what it is that I am not allowed to do, and I'll try to avoid doing it if I can. So LaValle is trying to lay down a particularized suggestion here about one of the things that bargaining good faith does not permit. And what is that? Is it raising a new issue? Is that enough?
Not necessarily.
I think it comes from why they're raising. Like originally, the offset accounting, they might have been willing to do without it, but when the interest rates went down, that became crucial, because otherwise it's not a good deal at all.
So I can raise something new, but I can't say you have to agree to this and I won't before I do anything else? Well, that's a possibility. What if what they said has to be agreed upon first was a term which is always present in some form or another in every commercial loan agreement? They just haven't talked about it yet. It's not in the term sheets, but on the other hand, it is in every agreement. Would that have been bargaining in bad faith? Suppose that the, let's take an easy one. Suppose that the Tribune said, okay, but in the loan agreement, the loan agreement has to say that if we have any disagreements about the performance of this contract, it must be arbitrated in London. Restrictions to arbitration as opposed to adjudication are fairly common. Arbitration in London is not that unusual. They have a highly regarded arbitration system in London. Is it that it was brand new? That is, as a term in the contract with TIA, that's one thing. It was brand new. Is it that it was posed as a, you have to agree to this before we negotiate about anything else? Is that it? Was it that it was not a term which was ordinarily to be found in a commercial agreement? Not a kind of standard term, standard issue that you'd expect in a commercial loan agreement? Does it have to be all three of those? you can see how this is very much a central concern of yours when you're trying to advise your client about what to do. So suppose your client came to you and said, look, we haven't talked about this at all, but you know, I really don't like adjudication. I particularly don't like adjudication in New York. So I want to have is on my proposition that if we have a disagreement, it has to be arbitrated. I prefer that we say it has to be arbitrated in London. If he doesn't agree to it, maybe I'll fall back and say it can be an arbitration in New York. But are you going to say to your client, no, you can't do that because nowhere up to this point had you introduced, and you say, I want to say to him that we have to agree on that first before we go on and negotiate about the rest of the things we have to negotiate about. Can I do that, counsel? Or would Judge LaValle think that was bad faith? So if I have the bad luck to draw him in the Southern District of New York, I lose. Or would you say, no, that's okay? Because it's true that you hadn't raised it before, but you should have, but you hadn't. And it's true that you're proposing that you won't go ahead with the rest of the negotiation until that issue gets settled. So you're giving it a kind of priority. On the other hand, this is a kind of question which frequently has a place to play in the negotiation between a lender and a borrower. How will disputes be resolved? In what form will they be resolved? Okay. Do you see that that is a question? Do you understand the difference? Okay. Now, we don't really know the answer, of course. LaValle doesn't have to answer that question. Because LaValle could say, if he were sitting here, well, Professor, all three of these were true in this case. So I don't have to answer your hypothetical question of what if only if the first two were the same, but in the case of the third one. But we do know something about this. What is his reaction when he refers to, I'll call it usage of the trade, when he refers to the kind of terms that are ordinarily negotiated about? Not that the terms specifically come out a particular way, but these are the terms that are typically the issues that are typically negotiated in loan agreements. Does the tone with which he addresses those differ than the tone in which he addresses this issue of the accounting methodology that would be permitted by Tribune's accountant?
Well, he's very clear. He says that the courts, they're not out of the typical usage out of the marketplace, and to show that they would have had to prove that the Tribune had to prove that this kind of binding thing was outside of the normal stuff. So I'm not on the right track now.
Well, I don't know. I mean, he's talking about what Tribune. I mean, Tribune, as far as Tribune is concerned, Tribune, what do they want?
They want to get out of it.
They want to get out of it. Why? We haven't talked about that. Let's articulate. Why do they want out of it?
Because the rates have gone down.
Yeah, the interest rates are down. That's easy, right? That's frequently the reason why people want to get out of deals is that what looked like a great deal at the point that they made it then doesn't look so good because the interest rates have gone down. And therefore, now there will be more lenders who are interested in making this loan, and they will make it on more favorable terms. It's also possible they didn't want to do the deal at all because now they weren't going to get the accounting treatment that they wanted. It's perfectly clear that the new accountant they got is not going to go for this. So the combination was a real killer. And so the court thought, and you can't tell how much this was a motivating factor, the court felt that, you know, these arguments that counsel are making for Tribune, these are all make-weight, these are all make-weight arguments. They're not the real reason why, why did this whole deal fall through? The whole deal fell through because Tribune thought that the terms were no longer the best deal that they could make. And that made them a very unappealing candidate, of course, for judicial treatment. And it makes it much more appealing to say about TIAA, who's the straight-up guy in this story? They just did their thing. They made a loan commitment. They were made to put aside the money. They were sitting there ready to go. They're sitting there trying to negotiate the usual terms of a loan agreement, and they were met with this response on the part of Tribune: no, we're not going to talk to you unless you agree to build in a condition that we get the accounting treatment we want from our accountant. Strange provision, of course, and not one that you would ordinarily expect to be demanded in a loan arrangement. I don't know, but it shows you one of the reasons, and you've probably seen this many times before, why it's really difficult to advise clients. We have a particular case. It's an important case. It's very well known. It's highly regarded. And yet, when it comes to the detail with which we have to advise our clients, it only just tells us so much. It helps us identify whether we've reached the point where bargaining in good faith is probably going to be required. Because in applying these New York standards, we get to see more of what these standards mean for how a court's going to decide, okay, they've reached the point where bargaining good faith is now required. On the subject of what is bargaining good faith, we learn a little less. Because we have at least three things, if you will, that are to be pointed to. And we're not sure what would happen if it were true that they said that they hadn't mentioned before the term, for example, my hypothetical arbitration in London, that the way in which they approached the negotiation was, you have to agree on this first before we'll talk about the others. And that raises a question, well, was that not good faith negotiation? On the other hand, would those two have been unimportant if it had not been for the oddity of the character of this particular provision? If it instead been a provision like dispute resolution, what law is applicable? What constitutes default? 15 days late payment, 30 days late payment, 45 days late payment, what constitutes default? So there were a lot of things that they had to negotiate that are not decided yet, because they never got to that point. But this particular term was one which you wouldn't ordinarily find. So at least I take out of this case, maybe incorrectly, the notion that the one thing that I do know is I could tell my client, if you're going to raise an issue which is kind of outside of the box of the things that are ordinarily negotiated over commercial loan arrangements, don't raise it as a killer. Don't say we have to agree on this before we can go anyplace else. Because that, we know, at least the Southern District of New York is going to be decided to be bad faith bargaining. But how much beyond that I can go is not clear. Okay. What remedy? This is a very hard problem in these cases. It's not really particularly taken up in this case. It is in a couple of note cases that follow it. What remedy? Well, we know that there are only a few possibilities. The one that most, the quickest one, I think, that would occur to me if I were sitting as a judge would be, well, look, there's no contract here. You know, it was a duty to bargain in good faith. Not really reached the point of contract. They breached the duty to bargain in good faith. Let's give them reliance damages. Isn't that the one which most, that's the one that goes down easiest, right? There's not going to be any restitutionary damage here. You're not going to be able to prove what benefits the party who's found to have been the breaching party got, because there weren't any that could be easily quantified. But we can always show some reliance damage, and in this case, TIA might be able to show opportunity cost, opportunity losses, because they do enough lending So they might be able to show at that moment in time what they could have made this loan for. That is, what would be the average interest rate that they could have commanded and what maturity date. And they may have, that may not be too speculative in their case because it's a very large outfit and they make large loans all the time. However, could they get expectation damages? Are expectation damages appropriate when what you have is not a final bargain that's been breached, a final contract has been breached, but rather some interim arrangement with the creation of a duty to bargain in good faith, which has been breached?
Maybe that, well, they can only get expectation damages. They would have, they would be getting the, but they don't know if it would go through. So maybe you could look at how certain it would be that it would go through. Like if
okay, so that's one thing. Issue, how certain it is, what the likelihood that it'll go through, and there's one other issue of certainty.
The other problem is a lot of the terms aren't set.
A lot of the terms are not set. So the only way to get expectation is if you manage to prove to the court a high probability that the deal would have gone through and a clarity about what the contract would have been. And that depends, of course, on how much detail has been agreed to by the parties before they reached this point of breach of what is said to be the duty to bargain in good faith. The more, the closer they are to a full agreement, the more possible it may be for the court to give expectation, or at least that's what some courts have said. Other courts have said, no, it's really reliance damages are the appropriate damages in this kind of situation. Now, that could be substantial, because keep in mind that this has been going on for some time. I've got a lot of time and labor that has gone into this transaction on TIA's part. And I can probably get the opportunity loss, but even though I couldn't get that, I may have fairly substantial out-of-pocket expenses that I could show are related to the work that I've done on this transaction. You know, I've had to have people study the deal and create this responding term sheet that went back to Tribune and so on and so forth. Okay. Now, one of the cases that I know you'll like, this, because this one's very complicated, and I'm sure that unless you love business, this last one was probably not too appealing to you, at least in terms of its facts. But who could dislike the Hoffmans? The poor Hoffmans. Poor Hoffmans, right? And he's got a nice bakery business. He runs with his wife, and he has aspirations. He has dreams. He wants to run a Red Owl store. A Red Owl doesn't mean anything. It's out in the Midwest, so think of yourself as wanting to run a, manage a Big Y or a Stop and Shop. Anyway, it's what he wants. And so he gets involved in discussions with this guy, Lukowitz, kind of regional manager for Red Owl. Red Owl, unlike the grocery stores around here, Red Owl runs a kind of franchise agreement. This is really more like McDonald's than it is like Big Y and Stop and Shop. They are chains, and there is, each store has a manager, but they have no ownership of it. This is like Friendly's, too, not like McDonald's. McDonald's is a franchise arrangement, so is Burger King, so is Kentucky Fried Chicken. Friendly's is not. All those stores are owned by the Friendly Ice Cream Corporation. So Red Owl runs franchises. They run a franchise arrangement. He wanted to be a Red Owl owner, franchisee. And they discuss two kinds of things to it with him. One is money, and the other is experience. Now, to start with, let's make this clear. These are perfectly legitimate concerns on the part of Red Owl. He's going to be a owner of a Red Owl store. They have to make sure that he's got enough money to make a go of this. And when they first start talking to him, all he's ever run is a bakery. And I love bakeries. I bake and I love bakeries. But it's not like running a grocery store. The number of different items that you handle is very much smaller. You produce everything, virtually everything, or everything that you're going to sell, you produce. So it's very different than the Red House store, when everything that you sell is something you've bought from someone else, from a supplier. So Lukowitz says, look, you got to get broader experience. So what he does is he says, you've got to run a grocery store. So Hoffman and his wife sell out the bakery, the business at least, and then start a store. And they run a grocery store. And you know, he's pretty good at it. He's making some money. So the people from Red House come in and they see him and they say, oh, okay, you're doing well. Sell it. Move on. Get yourself some property that you're going to be have a Red House store. And he says, I don't want to sell it right now. This is a seasonal operation. We're getting near summer. This is when most of the money gets made. I'm going to wait until fall. No, no, no. Sell it right away. Don't worry about the profit you'd make over the next. By the fall, you're going to be into a Red House store. Hubba hubba. So he sells it. And then everything goes to hell. Gets a piece of property, puts $1,000 down of his own money, buys property for what, $6,000, puts $1,000 down. Then he starts meeting with Red House accountants. Now, after all, if I look at this in the framework of what we know about mutual assent, we'd certainly say that they have not yet reached a point of mutual assent. Is that not true? Is it fair to say they've not reached the point of mutual assent? I mean, they're leading them around by the nose and all that, but have they reached the point of mutual assent? Have they actually had gotten an agreement for all the kinds of things that are going to have to be agreed upon between a franchisor and a franchisee starting a brand new store, that doesn't exist at that point? No, they have a lot of things to talk about. Well, okay, then have we reached the point that the court, that Judge LaValle found had been reached between Tribune and TIA, or Judge Becker found had been reached between the lumber company and Grossman? That is, have they reached the point at which they each have a duty to bargain in good faith?
I know the court didn't go that way, but it seems like they could have said that. I mean, they had agreed on some essential terms that, you know, how much he would have to put down.
But let's think about that. Did they really? They talked about $18,000. In the end, did he have $18,000? I think the answer to my question is yes and no, right? What does it depend upon?
What point you consider their negotiations,
because
they're changing. So,
well, see, I understand that, and we're going to talk about that issue too separately, but how much is 18? I mean, because after all, the court seems really hung up on the fact that they said 18,000, 18,000, 18,000. My question for you is, did he have $18,000 in cash to put into this transaction?
He had a gift from his father.
Ah. He had money from father or father-in-law?
Father-in-law.
He had money from his father-in-law. Is that the same? I mean, in fairness, we're gonna jump all over Red Al, and I know you like Hoffman, he's a nice guy, and he's been put ahead. I understand all that. But push comes to shove. Did he have $18,000? The answer is no, he had to borrow it. whether it's going to be a gift. Are we sure it's going to be a gift? No, we're not sure it's going to be a gift, because his father-in-law seems to want it. Well, maybe it's a loan, or maybe he wants a partnership, or maybe he wants something. Is that some equity of some kind or another? So, but they talked about 18,000, and that number did seem to hang in, and maybe the number they're talking about is higher than 18,000, although it all depends how you do the numbers in terms of what he had to put up as opposed to some other sources of money. Well, okay, so the court does not, your answer is correct, the court does not say they had reached the point at which they had a duty to bargain in good faith. Now here's the interesting problem with this case. Had they decided that, is it clear that Red Owl was not bargaining good faith? Did they introduce any unreasonable demands? Did they introduce anything that was outside the purview of things that you would have expected to be talked about between Red Owl or someone in Red Owl's position and Hoffman or someone in Hoffman's position? Were any of the terms outrageous? See, if they had gone the route of talking about this as, okay, they reached the duty to bargain in good faith, we would have had to go back to a jury and ask a jury a question which they were not asked. That is, do you think that they bargained in bad faith? And the testimony would have been addressing that subject from both sides. That, of course, is not the way the case was tried. So an interesting question. If you were representing Red Owl, would you have been better off saying, well, Your Honor, this is a case of, preliminary negotiation, and we're sorry that it never came to fulfillment. He put a lot of effort into it, so did we. And if we've bargained in bad faith, then so be it. You should tell us that, and we'll be liable for damages, or we'll find them in another store, or whatever we can do. On the other hand, we think we bargained in good faith. It's just that we didn't come to a final agreement. We just couldn't make the deal work in the end. That would be their position, and it would have gotten them a new trial, which you always want if you're on the losing side. They got a partial new trial, but only on a very limited issue, which we'll get to. Okay, so they didn't decide it that way. How did this case get decided? On what basis? It's your old friend, Section 90! Yay for Section 90! Right, comes riding in on the white horse. Yeah, Section 90. Now, this is interesting. When we talked about Section 90, what contract requirement were we talking about Section 90 substituting for? Consideration. Consideration. What's it doing here? Does this have to do with consideration? There's no question about consideration in this case. If they come to agreement, there's plenty of consideration on both sides. Nobody was making any gift promises which were relied upon. There's no unbargained for reliance here. There's lots of reliance, but it's all bargained for. So what role does Section 90 play?
It's the only way to prevent injustice, not enforce any.
That's right. Preventing injustice. There's a little provision here that was invented for the purpose of handling the fact that courts required consideration to make a promise enforceable is now being used as a general jurisprudential notion that we, the court, stand to prevent unfairness. Was there any unjust enrichment, by the way? Red Al get anything out of this? Not a thing. Not a thing. The issue here is whether or not Hoffman gets compensated for some losses that he ascribes to the getting pulled around by Red Al as he chases around trying to do all the things that he thinks will make him eligible to be a Red Al owner. So the injustice comes purely, as you correctly say, from Reliance. And it was ironically Reliance that was bargained for in every sense that I can think about it. They were saying, if you want to be a Red Al owner, get out of the bakery and run a grocery store. If you want to be a Red Al owner, get out of the grocery store and come buy land or get a lease on land for your Red Al store. His actions in responding to those were certainly not unbargained for. They were certainly foreseeable. They certainly were not unbargained for. So this court is saying Section 90 stands now, apparently, in this court, in this jurisdiction, for a much broader proposition than it was ever conceived of by the folks who wrote it into that 1917 Restatement of Contracts first, or the 1977 Restatement of Contracts second. Not to say it's wrong, but it is really quite an extraordinary enlargement of the notion, moving it well away from the doctrine of consideration into an otherwise very different area. Now, Hoffman versus Red Al has not been followed in many jurisdictions. It's not unique. There are a couple of others, but not many. The reason for that, of course, is that it seems to trespass on the core notion of contract law that you don't have a contract until you have mutual assent. And there's no liability, aside from unjust enrichment restitution, there's no liability for what happens during a negotiation that does not come to a contract. And while this case perhaps could have been tried on this notion that over this prolonged negotiation period, some moment had arisen in which the parties now had a duty to bargain in good faith, that was not the basis upon which the court was decided, and it's not at all clear what the outcome would have been if that had been the jurisprudential notion, the concept, the rule applied to this case, because we don't really know whether or not a jury would find that Red Al had bargained in bad faith or not. Now, once you decided it was Section 90, how is the remedy decided? What did the court do about the remedy here? Because that's really what the court is quite explicit about.
Reliance.
Yeah, it's Reliance damages. Right, and the only issues, the battle about the issue of how much, you know, was this act or that act, it, quote, in Reliance. Of course, you always have that question. But the theory of damages is clearly just a Reliance theory of damages. So this is where the law is now, on this question of, well, what happens when things break down during a lengthy negotiation? And you can see that lawyers worry about this area a lot, because this prolonged negotiation practice has gotten more and more common. That may be because there are too many lawyers who get involved early on. But for whatever reason, lots of them go on, and the complexity of these initial agreements that parties make, these letters of intent, they're frequently called, not always. The complications have gotten very great. But it won't surprise you to know that what they've begun to do is to build in what are, in effect, liquidated damage clauses into these preliminary letters of intent. That is, they'll say, if we fail to come to an agreement, then, and they'll talk about who has to pay who what. I take it that that is at least in part because they, A, understand that the court is likely to find that at that point there is a duty to bargain in good faith, and now they don't want to have litigation about the question of who bargained in good faith or who bargained in bad faith. They would rather handle it by liquidated damage clauses. And so that's what's going on. It's interesting, interesting practice. But you know what it does? Is all of this increases the cost. Let me tell you the downside of this from a public policy point of view. The recognition by the court of this duty to bargain in good faith and the practices of the parties as they emerge in response to that increases the cost of coming to agreement. More lawyers, more accountants, more everybody. Because the negotiations now, before this, well, I can negotiate, negotiate. You know, if it comes to be, it comes to be. If it doesn't, it doesn't. I'm not going to worry about it. I'm not going to put anything in writing. If there is, it'll be fragmentary. But now, I have a choice. Either I keep it all oral and I refuse to have anything, or I have a letter of intent. Well, let's see, the problem is from a business point of view, I want to have some feeling that these others, this other side is serious. And that's what produces letters of intent. But once I produce the letter of intent, maybe then I and they have duties to bargain in good faith, and we're not exactly sure what that means. As the courts say over and over again, it cannot mean that one party is liable if the negotiation fails. It cannot mean that. It cannot mean that a party can't be stiff-necked about a negotiation and say, look, this is the way I want this provision. It's got to be. It can't mean that that is inappropriate, because that is happens in every negotiation. There's some point that one party feels that I actually absolutely have to have this. And I'm not talking about something that's kind of outside of the ballpark, the way this accounting treatment was. I'm talking about just sort of a regular provision of the contract. And it can come apart in surprising ways. So you can say, okay, well, I want a warranty that's going to extend for 5 years over these goods that I'm buying from you. The seller says 5 years? I'm accustomed to warranty, but my standard warranty is 1 year. Well, I'm sorry, you want to sell those to me, you're going to warrant them for 5 years. And it falls apart. And there was a letter of intent that didn't mention, it said the goods will be warranted, but it didn't say for how long. Clearly had to be negotiated. It's within the bounds of good practice, it's within the bounds of the letter of intent, but it wasn't resolved by the letter of intent. Is it bad faith for a business person to say, no, sorry, I demand 5 years, and the other side saying, look, I'll compromise and go longer than I usually go, but I'm not going to 5 years. Can't mean that. So the exact definitions of what good faith means are troublesome. We do have a much better feel now in law for when the duty to bargain in good faith probably does arise. And that's new. That's within the last couple of decades. Pretty new. Didn't exist when I was in law school. But it exists now, fairly well accepted by most courts in the United States. However, now we have to resolve what we mean by bargaining in good faith. And that is far from resolved. Okay. We move on. I think our next assignment for next week is, I think we start the parole evidence rule.